to Big Web Show, episode number 93. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and today's guest is Mark Otto, creator of Bootstrap. Today's episode is sponsored by Lynda.com. You can learn it at Lynda.com, an online learning company with more than 98,000 video tutorials that teach software, creative, and business skills. Membership starts at $25 a month and provides unlimited 24/7 access to top quality video courses taught by expert instructors with real world experience. And that's definitely true. All the really smart people I know that have made books and such have done videos for Lynda. Learn anytime, anywhere, and at your pace, your own pace, from bite-sized tutorials to comprehensive courses in web design, development, business, photography, audio and video, 3D and animation. Sharpen your skills in Bootstrap. Sharpen your skills in Bootstrap, jQuery, CSS. I wonder why they wanted to sponsor this episode. Sharpen your skills in Bootstrap, jQuery, CSS, JavaScript, HTML, user experience, content strategy, and more. With new courses added every week, the Lynda.com library helps you keep pace with the fast-changing technical and software skills required by today's working professionals. Try Lynda.com for free for 7 days by visiting lynda.com/bigwebshow. And that really is true. It really will be free. And I hope some folks listening will do that, because sponsors like Lynda.com keep this show on the interwebs. With no further ado, Mark Otto. Let me tell you a little something about Mark Otto. He's currently designing things at GitHub. He's the creator of Bootstrap, not a co-founder, he's the creator of Bootstrap. He was previously at Twitter. Before that, he was at another well-respected agency, whose name escapes me, but I will think of it in a second. And he is a Broheim. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Jeffrey.
Thanks for making the time today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And I got to say, after hearing you speak for an hour in Newfoundland a couple of weeks back, it's really nice to finally hear your voice.
It's one of those things I would find myself saying either, but I'm glad I'm hearing my voice again as well.
you were at Go Beyond Pixels 2013.
Yes, I was.
Newfoundland, yeah. As was I. A really wonderful conference. And you talked to yourself raw.
Yeah, I had I was all dried out from the flight and some bad sinus and allergy pressure and everything. And during the hackathon, which went on for about 6 hours the day before, I just felt it get raspier and raspier and raspier. And then it just tweaked and went out and no voice. And so I delivered my first talk without a voice. Kind of weird.
Were you shouting code, you devil's code? Were you cheerleading? I mean...
No, I was just Levin, the organizer for Go Beyond Pixels, an awesome guy, super nice. He asked me to host the hackathon, and so in my mind, that meant doing as much as I could to talk to those folks who, you know, paid good money to come out there and learn and hack and work. And so I made sure to make the rounds as much as I could. So I spoke for a few minutes ahead of time before it started, and then I just went around and spoke to, you know, 20, 30 people for 6 hours straight, basically. And I had a lot of fun doing it. It was awesome.
Throat pain aside, is that your favorite kind of... I mean, do you prefer that to, like, giving a lecture to a lot more people? What's your favorite kind of educational interfacing with the public these days?
I like a good mix of things. Like, I think that the conferences like Go Beyond Pixels are actually a really good size, being that they're around 200 or less. And the interactions you get with people during the conference, between talks, and then afterwards at the party or before, if you do a hackathon or any kind of meetup, I get the most value out of that, because it's great to see how these people's lives have changed or can be changed by a conference or by a framework or by, you know, just anybody's thoughts on web development and design. And you don't really, I feel like haven't gotten that interaction from a lot of the bigger conferences. And I like a good mix of it, I guess, more than anything else.
And you like the hands-on workshop stuff?
That was actually I did another one about a month ago in Vegas for Future Insights Live, where it was only an hour long, and I walked people through how to create some new stuff with Bootstrap 3, the yet to be released version of the next released of Bootstrap. And people seem to really enjoy it. And then the hackathon was fun just to like hash through people's ideas. So it's always cool to have like that difference of context for me when I'm going to give a talk, to be able to just, you know, one-on-one or a few on-one, just talk about what these people are thinking and what they want to do. It's really cool. It's really cool to get excited as they're getting excited, explaining it to you. And that's just kind of infectious. And you walk away at the end of the day feeling a lot more invigorated about what you do. So
I was at a conference in Vegas once. I woke up with a chicken and I think I was married for like 4 hours. I'm not sure.
Did you actually wake up with a chicken?
I did. And my friend was missing. It was a hole. I don't remember anything else really.
Yeah.
But it's a strange place for conferences, I find.
Yeah. It was really warm, and the conference, the conference that I was at was in the MGM Grand, which if you haven't been to MGM Grand, it is huge.
And so I've seen the movies. I haven't really been there.
It took like 10 minutes to get from my hotel room in the hotel to get to the conference room, also in the hotel, which was weird. I think Vegas, like Austin's actually a decent place for people to all meet up if they're coming from different directions of the country.
Right.
Which is also, I think, some of the biggest appeal of going to Austin for South By or anything like that. Right.
So. Yeah. I was at, the Builder Conference in 2002, mm-hmm. actually September 11th, 2002, 1 year after the attacks. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I remember at the time saying, how can I possibly, I'm a New Yorker, how can I possibly speak on September 11th, 2002? And, mm-hmm. and my then wife saying, well, if you don't, the terrorists will win. So I went, and ours was in, I want to say Little Caesars, but it's actually Caesar's Palace. Have you been to Caesar's Palace?
I haven't actually.
That is like, it's kind of like watching The Godfather on acid. Must be. It's just such a strange experience.
That must be how it is, because you haven't done that yourself.
I haven't done that, but it was a good conference too. It was a good conference too. You speak a lot these days.
Working on it, yeah. It's just kind of how it's ending up. I did the first talk I did publicly was actually at Rebuild back in October in Indiana.
October of this year?
Last year. 2012.
Okay.
And that was also, I mean, very similar to Go Beyond Pixels, you know, about 200 people or less, put on by two or three people and their volunteers, and had a lot of fun being there. I mean, it was Indiana in the fall. The Midwest in the fall is beautiful.
Bloomington?
It was a few more months. Yeah.
Was it Bloomington?
No, it was in Indianapolis.
Indianapolis. Sorry, I missed that. Yeah. No. I went to school in Bloomington.
Oh, cool.
And we used to go to Indianapolis. We called it Indiano Place back then. It's really nice now, but
everyone cracked that joke there too.
Back in the day.
It was great to be back in the Midwest though for that, especially for fall, because fall is beautiful in the Midwest.
Because that's where you're from. You're a Midwesterner. You're from.
Yeah, I'm originally from Wisconsin. I moved out to California when I was 20, back in 2007.
Which is where the cheese comes from.
Yeah, less and less, I guess, these days. I mean, California stole all those dairy subsidies from the government years ago, and now we got happy cows out here. I guess our cows back in Wisconsin aren't so happy. I don't know.
Okay, well, we're not going to talk about politics.
Let's not get into that.
Absolutely.
Dangerous business.
It is a dangerous business. It is a dangerous business. You're a Broheim. What does that mean?
Broheim... So that all kind of came about.
I mean, let me ask you this. Are you taking sides in the war over inclusion?
No.
Okay. You realize that's kind of a provocative word in that when framed in that context.
Maybe. I can see how people would think that. Think that I'm like a programmer or that I'm kind of, you know, sexist or anything like that. That couldn't be further from the truth.
Okay.
And in your email, you mentioned that, hey, we might talk about this because it's in your bio and everything. And I was like, yeah, that's actually, I don't really think about the fact that I do put that on my site and it's in my bio. And I don't really remember why.
It's a linked word.
Yeah. Well, I looked it up actually on Urban Dictionary. And the first definition actually is pretty interesting. It reads, a kinsman, a fellow man or colleague, brethren, referring to a friend or a brother as such. And so,
yeah, me, like in high school, we would call each other that when we were like at a party,
yeah,
doing things teenagers aren't supposed to do. You're like, so hey, Broheim, pass me that.
Yeah,
pass me that whatever. Or
yeah, I never used the word actually or any kind of bro words really until I came out to California, and it's just me and a couple of our good friends, and it kind of, I think, just started as a joke, and it's kind of like escalated. Like, people don't say bro anymore. They say bruh, like B-R-U-H or brah, or, you know, B-R-A-H.
Who are these people?
It's interesting. I think it's all, you know, the 20-somethings here in the Valley or anywhere else, you know, working in tech. I think it's mostly a joke, you know, and just kind of ways of, like, you know, having fun with people when you say words, right? Like, it's a way of lightening it up. But the Broheim thing is there to try to keep people a little bit on their toes and try to let them know. Hopefully not that I'm sexist. That's not what I want. But that, I'm just here to meet awesome people and have fun working with them. Like, my goal on the internet with, whether it's with Bootstrap or with, if it's with GitHub or Twitter or anything like that. And then it's meeting them at conferences. It's to help awesome people on the internet do awesome stuff. And that's what I want to do. And if that makes me your kinsman or your fellow colleague or anything like that, that's what I want to embody, and that's what I want to help people do.
Well, I like that very much. And yeah, and so let's get to Bootstrap.
All right.
What's the history of Bootstrap? Where did it begin?
Bootstrap.
Where were you working, and what were you doing, and why did you create it?
I was working at Twitter, actually. And when I started at Twitter, that was February of 2010. And I started, and we were still on old Twitter. And if you remember, old Twitter had the Lucida Grand font, and had like the nice baby blue and the clouds in the background, the sidebar on the right as you looked at it. And I got there, and I realized there was maybe a need for a style guide for all of our internal tools and things like that that people were working on. And I wanted to base it on the website. So I started working on that, and then we started redesigning the site, and I was like, what's the point in making a style guide for a site that we're redesigning right now? So I abandoned that, and a couple months later...
Who had assigned you to create a style guide?
Nobody really assigned me to do it. I just kind of started wanting to do it.
For the sake of your own development work?
Yeah, basically, because I was a brand new designer there, and I was maybe the seventh designer at the time. There were only 130 people at Twitter at that point. And I wanted a quality resource that I could go to and just, you know, snag, link, you know, actually all the Twitter colors for the brand, a font, a logo, or anything like that, right? So it started off as just kind of like trying to solve my own problems. And I abandoned that because we were going to redesign the site then. So all that stuff was going to change. And I was like, what's the point in doing that? And my attention shifted to the things that I was actually, you know, paid to do. I was hired to do. And I was hired as designer on the revenue team. And
the revenue team.
The revenue team. Which,
Twitter has a revenue team?
Well, 3 years ago, it was interesting because it was the revenue team, or the promoted products team, as we called it. But we didn't even have anything. We weren't really making revenue off that stuff yet.
Like, are you talking about, just so we're clear, things like a corporation comes to Twitter and says, we want a lot of hip young followers. And Twitter says, well, give us $1 million and you'll have them. Like,
yeah, that
I'm
happens
simplifying, but yeah, that happens,
yeah, no,
right?
Promoted tweets, promoted accounts, promoted trends.
So, you know, if you're the Roots, well, you don't need that. Or, you know, if you're popular innately, you probably don't need that. But if you're becoming popular or trying to become more popular, you might use that service, right?
Yeah, if you're a small business, you might want to run promoted accounts or promoted tweets. If you're a big business, maybe like Pepsi or Coke or Starbucks, those are all, or Coke and Starbucks were definitely like early customers of promoted trends. They'd buy a global trend for the day. You know, that's a lot of money, but they get so many views on that, so many tweets about it. So it was definitely effective, and it was potent stuff.
Did they get to pick the trend?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Because there are some trends you really wouldn't. I mean, sometimes some really horrible stuff will just become viral on Twitter.
Yeah.
And for the day, like, yeah. And so like every junior high school boy in the country or the world is tweeting about some horrible thing, and you don't really want. From Starbucks, brought to you, you know.
Yeah, there was also, I distinctly remember there was a point at which It's actually kind of like a scene out of Mad Men, the first season of Mad Men, where an airline was running an ad, promoted ads, and then a plane crashed. And it was like, oh, quit, you panic, like, got to take those ads down, right? And so we had people freaking out because the very few people actually saw that ad. But, I mean, it was the same kind of thing. It was crazy.
I used to be in advertising, and that really does happen.
Yeah, it really does. Like, I didn't think that it did, and then it actually did happen, and I was like, this is straight out of a TV show. This is crazy.
Mohawk Airlines on Mad Men.
Yeah, exactly.
So I won't ask you what plane crashed or anything. That's horrible. But so what exactly were you supposed to design in terms of promoted tweets? Were you supposed to, like, design some little funky thing that said promoted, like a little banner? I mean, were they hiring you to do that?
Basically. That and a lot more. So I was the one that first designed all the promoted badges, basically, is what we were calling them. Because a few years ago, it was actually a textual, like, pill or badge. And now it's just a little icon, a little up into the right arrow. But we went through dozens of iterations of, like, how do you display promoted content in your user's timeline without making it look like it's not supposed to be there at first? But then when they actually focus on it, they immediately realize, oh, that's paid content. It's inserted. I understand why it's here. And so we went through a lot of work to try to do that.
You did a little orange arrow?
Yeah, I did.
It's nice.
Thank you. It's a small arrow, but it works. It's effective. Had a lot of help from everyone else on the team for that, and all the iterations that we went through to explore all those.
Would you present stuff to Doug Bowman? Is that how it worked?
Yeah, and the rest of the designers, and then all the PMs and anyone else at Twitter that had a stake in it. It was great because the design team was so small and so passionate there that and there was a lot of, like, cross-pollination. Like, being that there was only, you know, 7 or 8 designers there, we would just all get together and kind of do design review.
So there's 7 or 8 designers at Twitter when you left?
No, that was when I started. And now I think the design team, which includes their, they recently shifted this one team off to the marketing team, but it was like all their product marketing, sales marketing folks. They do a lot of PDFs, one pagers, the marketing sites. All in all, and with the videographers as well, it was like 50 designers now that work there.
Videographers, documenting Twitter processes, or
they make the videos for new features when those get rolled out. They make video, just funny videos sometimes too. They're now part of the marketing team, so that takes away 10 people or so from the count, but it's still about 40 people, I believe, that work at Twitter now just on the design team. And that includes the mainstream clients, as they call it, so twitter.com, iOS, Android, their HTML5 client. And then all of their promoted products, they've got a couple of folks working on that. Onboarding new users, the growth team, got a bunch of people working on that stuff too. So,
and when you design, do you design in Photoshop, Fireworks, HTML, CSS, and JavaScript? What do you...
Most of the stuff that I do lately is all in HTML and CSS.
Okay.
Real quick, I want to make sure we finish what we originally started was. And on that note, like, all of Bootstrap started in HTML and CSS. Like, it wasn't any real Photoshop work that ever went into creating any of it, except for, you know, playing around with colors a little bit. You can't really do that.
Well, little arrow, that arrow was Photoshop or Fireworks, I imagine.
That was all Photoshop, yeah. Photoshop and Illustrator. I remember making the original one. I'm not very good at doing, like, pen tools or anything like that. Like, I don't have a formal background in design or anything like that. So I remember making the very first iteration for that. And it worked and it was effective. And then somebody else came in and cleaned it up and made it all better. So
I feel like I never learned to use Illustrator's pen tools, really. And, like, if I can die with the name, you know, and people say he was a designer and I never, I mean, I use them, but it's weird. It's like, I'm so strongly of the belief that if you're using HTML, you should understand what you're doing and not just write junk. And if you're using CSS, you should understand why things work, right? And all that. And I believe that with everything. And I believe, you know, with photography, and I study everything. But for some reason, the Bezier curve, I can't.
Yeah.
I think it's might Over be a left head. Brain, right brain thing, or there's just maybe. Something.
Yeah, so, I can't do it. So I mean, maybe it's because I did horrible at geometry in high school. But
Me too.
I don't know. Oh, there
that's
we go.
Interesting.
That's interesting. It's geometry.
And I also did badly in those Lewis Carroll math problems where they'd be like, if a policeman is not an alligator will not wear shoes. And then you're supposed to answer what, you know, do you know 42. What I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And I would just, I would try to figure out the storyline. Like, why isn't the alligator wearing shoes? Maybe his mother.
You go into a character analysis. Like, what's his motivation for not wearing shoes?
Totally. it's a mother thing. He has this really confused relationship with his alligator mother. Mm. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah.
So there you were at Twitter, seven designers at the time. Your job is to make badges and all kinds of other stuff in this particular division. And you're doing stuff in HTML and CSS anyway. Mm-hmm. That's where you're doing most of your design work. And you say, you know what? I'm going to make this easy for everybody else. Maybe. How did you have the chutzpah? It's not like, right? You know that word? Do they have that word in Wisconsin?
I have heard it before. Yes.
It's, it's not really arrogance, because that's the wrong, it's not that, but it's like the feeling that you're entitled to try something creative, and you know, even though your boss didn't tell you to do it. What, I don't know what that might be called.
Well, I guess, I mean,
self-confidence.
It's confidence, or it's I don't know how to describe it either exactly. I guess I just saw a need for something and decided to give it a go.
Did you work on it after hours, or did you say, Doug, I'd like to do
hours,
this?
After hours, weekends, nights, did you tell anyone you were going to do it?
Did you say, I'd like to do this, is it okay, or you just went for it?
No, I just kind of started working on it. The real premise for it was, in addition, I mean, when you make all these, when you add this functionality to a popular product like Twitter, right, you have all these ads on there, you're all of a sudden you're running ads. You have to build the tools to run those. So I designed the first, like some of the early versions of those as well. And then you need internal tools to moderate those, right? You need admin functionality so you can go ahead, you know, slap advertisers or promote them or fix bugs and or mistakes that people entered in their campaigns. So we needed an admin tool to go on top of that. And that was called Finch. And I remember you tweeted about this actually when I mentioned it at Go Beyond Pixels. And the Finch project was a bunch of engineers working on this awesome internal tool so that we could do these things. And I remember
Finch was the Twitter bird name.
That was the bird name. Yep. Yeah. And everything had a bird name.
And it was the beginning of.
Yeah, it was the product from which Bootstrap stemmed.
Okay.
And so what was happening is these engineers were doing all these things and they're like, yeah, we need some design help on this. And I was like, you know, I'd love to help you and I probably should. This is for our team, right? And so I started just designing, you know, like a header, a nav bar, some table styles, form styles, button styles, drop-down styles. I started just making these things for these folks, you know, off the cuff as they needed them. And it was very hands-off for me on the actual, all the functionality and everything and the actual product decisions that were going into that internal tool. But it was interesting because they would come to me and say, we need this. And I would work with them. I'd whiteboard, I'd sketch or kind of figure out a good solution for it. And while all that was happening, while I was contributing back to this one product, I was also copying everything from that off into another project, another folder on my desktop or wherever it was. And I was working on what I then called the Twitter blueprint. And Blueprint is another CSS framework. So the name was never going to stick. But
right.
People liked it better than Style Guide. But that's basically what it was, a glorified interactive style guide.
It's a strange and important transformation, I think. In the past, designers used to create style, and some still do, especially in the print world. But on the web, too, like often we'll ship something and we'll ship a style guide, which originally was this sort of, might be a web-based one or a PDF, but it was this sort of passive document saying, here are the rules about, you know, what, you know, how much space is required around the logo and how, you know, here are the lockups with the type and these are colors that we can use and all that stuff. And of course, we have content style guides too. But you're moving from, I mean, I think there's been a shift. Well, I would postulate there's been a shift from everyone in little categories, designers in one bucket, developers in another bucket, working separately and having their little fiefdoms and expertise. And that is what creates things like style guides.
Yeah.
Into designers are also developers. Designers creating cool digital stuff are developers and designers and the style guides themselves are really tools, frameworks to make other stuff. Like, why read about, you know, you wouldn't write. So when you are writing CSS, please employ this rule, or just like, just make it. Just make it and let someone grab it.
Yep.
So do you, I mean, do you agree that there's sort of this transformation going on in our industry led by things like Bootstrap that are changing how we think about style guides?
Oh, absolutely. I wrote about this in a blog post a few weeks ago, maybe a month or so ago.
Designer-developer spectrum, was it?
Yes, it was. And it was something that I think I first heard from Kyle Neath, who's more or less the design director at GitHub. Awesome guy. I've known him on the internet for a long time, and now I get to work with him, which is amazing. But he mentioned this, and it just kind of stuck with me, and I finally decided to put some more words down around it. I don't really think that there are any... Some people still believe that there's just designers, there's just developers, and some people are pretty adamant about it. I got in a Twitter argument, which you should never do on Twitter, but I did anyway because I like to indulge the haters. It's interesting because, yeah, the designer, when you're working on the web, there is very much this spectrum of knowledge. And one could argue there's many levels to the spectrum. Like, there's the designer spectrum, there's the developer spectrum, or it's all one spectrum. And you're either all designer, or you're all developer, or you're somewhere in the middle, or leaning one way or the other. For me, I think I lean a little bit more still to the design side, because I haven't gone fully into like a lot of the front end stuff. Like, I write a lot of HTML and CSS. It's pretty much all I do when it comes down to it. But I don't know that much JavaScript. I don't know that much Ruby on Rails. I can't do all that kind of fancy stuff yet. But I want to get there. So I want to move myself on that spectrum. But the notion that designers have really kind of changed the way the web is heading in terms of like how people learn and how they get stuff done is very much true. And we're just seeing it over and over and over again. I mentioned it also in my talk at Go Beyond Pixels that CSS kind of became an art form for a lot of people. And as for designers, I think that we just eat that stuff up. So when you make a Coke can out of CSS or Homer Simpson's head out of CSS, now that's art, right? Like, that's amazing. Like, that's pushing the boundaries of something and while making a statement. And maybe it's not so much about making statements, but I remember doing things like this and just thinking, like, my God, the future looks very bright for web development. And when I got started back, for me, that was in middle school, like, it was still tables. And like, I'd just been told, you know, don't use frames. And I had just made my first framed website. And I was like, well, that was kind of easy. And now you're telling me I can't do that. But people are definitely pushing it. And I mean, at that point, it was you that was pushing it.
Pushing frames?
Not to do frames, not to do tables, do standards, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing this and watching all of it, and I was just kind of like enthralled with it. And it's just kind of, I feel like it's accelerating today. And it's so easy for, I don't want to say it's so easy. There's so many opportunities in which a designer can go from being just a designer to being more of a developer, and a developer can go from that to being a designer.
But it's also daunting, isn't it?
Oh, incredibly. Like, I'm incredibly like scared and self-conscious of any kind of JavaScript that I write or anything that I kind of learn. I get very easily frustrated when I try to learn these more technical bits. Actually, programming, kind of like geometry, I just struggle with it. Like, my head just kind of gets a little flustered. And everything becomes more difficult than it really should be, including understanding the most basic things. So,
I just want to capture this in amber for the listeners. For the listeners who may be self-conscious, this is the creator of Bootstrap, and he feels flustered and doesn't think he's very good at JavaScript. So, just like,
I'm horrible,
you're not alone. None of us are alone.
We all wrote the JavaScript.
No, but we all share these feelings. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, clarify that.
So I created the original version of Bootstrap, which was Blueprint at Twitter, and it was just HTML and CSS. And this guy, Jacob Thornton, he's at Fat on Twitter and GitHub and like everywhere else. Awesome guy. He comes in, he started at Twitter a few months after I did, and he builds this entire Moo Tools library on top of Blueprint. And internally, it worked great. People used it, they loved it. And the number of teams using it really quickly grew, especially when we had the Moo Tools stuff added. And so Jacob is the one that actually pushed both of us to open source all the stuff that we had just done and released to the community. So we got together, and while we were working on the last redesign of Twitter.com, new Twitter, we released it in August of 2011. And we repackaged everything up, focused it on being not too Twittery. And Jacob rewrote all of the JavaScript he'd done in MooTools into jQuery. And we ended up releasing it kind of together. It came out, I think the JavaScript stuff got added another in a subsequent release, not the very initial release. But and now we're working on it together. So without Jacob's prodding and without Jacob's JavaScript, I don't know that we would have even open sourced Bootstrap. And I don't know that we'd be still working on it today, which is kind of crazy. But
you feel you made the right decision?
Oh, absolutely. I was astounded at the number of people using it and who started or watched it that first weekend when we released it on GitHub. I remember that weekend it went from like no stars, no watchers on GitHub to like 5,000 by Sunday. And I was like, my God, what did we do? What do we get ourselves into?
How many people use it now?
The number of stars on GitHub, it's going to pass 52,000. Probably tomorrow, this weekend or so, maybe early next week.
Does GitHub email you to notify you as you go up?
They don't. But it's something that we quickly became aware of as people were tweeting about it. I didn't even remember when I originally open sourced it. I don't think I even ever gone to the explore page on GitHub, which lists the popular repos and the by number of stars and by number of forks. And I remember when we passed Rails to be number one, and all these people from the Rails community were like, oh, why is this the number one thing on GitHub? Not all the people from the Rails community, but a couple of them on Twitter were being really vocal, and like they were upset that this HTML and CSS and JavaScript framework was at the top of this programming projects on the Explorer section of GitHub, and they just couldn't understand it. They're like, everyone unfollow, go unwatch Bootstrap and watch the Rails project just to get the numbers up. And I was like, went back and forth a little bit that day, and then we just kind of blew past them, and I guess we never looked back.
Well, I love Ruby on Rails, and we're certainly not going to diss that community. But it is, this is the classic thing that happens on the web. Thing has progressed to a certain level with HTML and CSS and JavaScript. Then someone comes out with something proprietary. People fall in love with it and commit to it. And then at a certain point, someone else goes, hey, look what we can do with HTML and CSS and JavaScript. And it's more advanced. Yeah. And it's just a cycle. I think that tension between the two, between proprietary and open standards, is kind of an interesting and good thing. I don't think standards would move very far without that tension, without that push and pull.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that there's a few things that I think really propelled Bootstrap to the top and why so many people do use it, both on GitHub and then the numbers. Like, I think I haven't looked exactly the number of downloads that we had, but I remember in less than a year, we had over 1 million downloads just from the site, the documentation there. Actually, maybe in 6 months we did. And that was crazy to me. But the things that I think really propelled it were, one, it had Twitter's name on it, and it still does. Soon it won't, or it'll be less prominent. We're going to move it out of the Twitter org on GitHub and move it into its own thing. So it won't be Twitter/Bootstrap. It'll be something else.
And who gave you permission to do that?
Longstanding plan between Jacob, myself, and the open source manager at Twitter, Chris. He's an awesome guy, and just given the level of activity, they've already done it with another project called Bower. They moved it out into its own organization just because it gets so much activity. And it's better for the permissions level as well, because what they had to do for us to keep committing to Bootstrap and a couple other repos is they make a new team and they give us permissions to access just those projects that we need to. And so it's better for them from a security perspective as a big company to say, no, go be your own project and deal with your permissions over there. That's separate from all the Twitter people that work on the Twitter org. So
that is amazing and great. Now, what do you say to people who don't like things like Bootstrap, don't like frameworks? Say, well, everything looks the same. Everybody's using Bootstrap. I'm so tired of all these Bootstrap sites that work and look the same way. Do you have a response to that criticism?
Yeah, I do. I've got a couple of them. This actually leads into the second thing that I think that really propelled Bootstrap to be so popular, in which it's HTML and CSS more than anything else. So there's a lot of JavaScript in there, but you don't need to use any of that. When it originally was released, it was HTML and CSS. Those are the building blocks of the internet. And there is no easier way to get started building something on the internet than by learning HTML and CSS. And when all these people are coming to the web and they want to learn how to build on the web, that's where they're going to start. And when they see something like Bootstrap that can help them get that done faster, get that done without the skills that they didn't have, you know, last week, if they'd never done this before, or if they made it help them make it look a little bit better or a little bit different than what they had originally imagined, that's awesome. That's all that I care about. If I'm helping all these people do these things, and there's a full spectrum of people here too that are doing this. There's all these beginners. There's all these moderate users. There's all these like crazy advanced people using it as like a baseline for their production sites. I mentioned earlier, my goal when I'm like most happy is when I'm helping people do awesome stuff. I want to enable people to do things that they otherwise could not do or could not do as well or as quickly or anything like that. So if that means that some of these sites end up looking the same or similar, well, I'm okay with that. And I remember somebody tweeting about this, it was a comment on Hacker News, I believe. They said, one person was like, oh, all these sites look the same. We can immediately tell when a new site on Hacker News is using Bootstrap. And some guy replied and he's like, well, is that really going to be so bad if Bootstrap becomes the default, you know, look and feel of the internet? And I laughed at it at first. And then I was like, well, that's kind of actually an interesting perspective. I think we could do worse personally.
And it's really up to the designer. I would think it's up to the designer to go, okay, well, this is my starting platform.
Exactly.
And now I'm going to, like you would if you had, I don't know, a WordPress template you would make it your own.
It's in the name. It's a Bootstrap, right? It's not meant to be an end solution, but it can be. And the reason it can be is a lot of people really identify or align themselves with the gradients, the shadows, all those kind of things that make it look a little bit more polished, right? Mm-hmm. The animations, the transitions, and everything.
Can they be a way to learn how to do those things by viewing?
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, there's a huge learning aspect to all these big frameworks. And I learned things by looking at other frameworks all the time and other tools and other websites. And that's how I got started, like dissecting websites, right?
That's how we all got started. Crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
You view source.
It was crazy for me. Quick story on that. I didn't remember who actually wrote this article, but it was a list apart article. And I remember reading it. Had to have been, I'm going to date myself and a lot of other people here, and they get angry with me when I do this. This was like late middle school for me, I think. Maybe my first year of high school. I remember reading this article, and it was called Sliding Doors. And it was for designing tabs in CSS and with a little bit of sprite images. And I was like, well,
You don't know who wrote it, or you didn't know?
I didn't remember at the time. And so it was a year or so into my time at Twitter before Doug Bowman, who was my boss, and he's the creative director at Twitter, he mentioned it. And I just looked at him. I remember we were in like a meeting room, and I just looked at him like my jaw dropped. And I was like, holy crap, it was you. You did this to me. You made me dissect projects and like learn on the web and everything. And I knew him, and I knew Doug obviously before I started there from Stop Design and, you know, all these big names in web design community when I was starting. But it was very interesting to then like have that flip and that realization at that point. I was like, that was like the first thing I remember learning actually in CSS, like these crazy CSS techniques, and it stuck with me. But it was definitely very cool to see.
And, he's a nice guy to work for, I would imagine.
He's an awesome guy to work with. I miss working with him actually, but good to see him every now and then since we both live in the city here.
I think everyone in San Francisco, everyone in San Francisco web startup space sort of knows each other. And my theory is it's like, do you ever watch a costume drama, like a Jane Austen novel filmization? Does your girlfriend ever make you watch one of those? And,
I'm lucky in that regard. My girlfriend likes sci-fi.
Okay. Well, if you ever happen to see it, and they're lovely. The way people danced 300 years ago, they start with a partner, and there's this very gentle music, and then they all move over one to the next partner, and then they all move over. That's how I see the San Francisco job scene and relationship scene. People are like, I used to be with the co-founder of this, but now I'm with the co-founder of that. And I used to work at this startup, but now I work at that startup. And, you know, it's kind of like the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I've compared to like my dad's had the same job for over 30 years, and I've had three different jobs in the last six.
There you go.
Right. Like it's entirely different, and it's a generational thing. It's an also like a geographical thing. Right. We're out here in the tech and in the tech scene in the bubble. Things change so quickly here. And they change a little bit slower, back in the Midwest. Right. But you know, there is definitely a lot of like ebb and flow to it. And, I like to think that the best folks out here don't really name drop as much as that, but I've gotten those from recruiters where it's like, here are a dozen people that we've worked with or that are all funding this project. I'm just like, well, mute or report a spam or anything like that in Gmail. I'm not interested in that. Like people out here, I think that the attitude's kind of shifting. It's less of, it's still kind of about who you know, which is kind of unfortunate, but it's more about just doing great things, right? Just having fun and shipping amazing things that hopefully change people's lives, right?
That's why we're, you know, front-end designers. That's what exactly. We want to do, right?
Yeah.
I'd like to thank Mark Otto for his time today. If you're interested in what Mark does, as why wouldn't you be, you can find out about it at markdotto.com. That's markdotto.com. And you can follow him on Twitter at MDO, which stands for Mark D. Otto, at MDO. You can also follow him on GitHub, same handle, MDO. That's it for Big Web Show 93. Thanks, everybody. See you soon.